This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, the producer of this week's program. In the last episode of our series on the Israel lobby, we'll be looking at how the lobby has responded to the October 7th attacks. First, though, news. Mobs of Jewish settlers, often accompanied or supported by Israeli soldiers, have been attacking Palestinian villages after a settler youth went missing April 12th and was found dead the following day. According to the Israeli human rights organization Yesh Din, at least 10 villages in the West Bank were attacked by settlers. 4 Palestinians have been killed and 25 others reported injured in the 4-day rampage that torched homes, buildings, and cars and destroyed livestock. A photographer covering the violence for an Israeli newspaper said he was hiding under a table in a burned house when he was attacked and mercilessly beaten by 20 to 30 people, many of them wearing the uniforms of the Israeli army. Aimed at driving Palestinians off their land, settler violence has increased threefold since the Hamas attack on Israel October 7th, with the UN Human Rights Office recording 7 attacks a day on Palestinians and their property. The UN demanded April 17th that Israeli security forces end their active participation in and support for attacks by settlers in the West Bank. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, said April 15th that Israel continues to impose unlawful restrictions on the entry and distribution of humanitarian aid in the Gaza Strip and to destroy civilian infrastructure. Turk urged other states with influence to halt what he said was the increasingly horrific human rights and humanitarian crises there. The University of Southern California has canceled a commencement speech by its valedictorian, who has publicly supported Palestinians. The university cited security concerns for the decision, which has been praised by several pro-Israel groups and criticized by Free Speech Advocates and CARE, the country's largest Muslim civil rights organization. Graduating senior Asna Tabassum said she was shocked by the decision and disappointed by the university succumbing to a campaign of hate meant to silence her voice. My guest today is Allison Weir, journalist, author, and founder and executive director of If Americans Knew, a nonprofit founded to educate the American public about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A conflict, she says, often goes unreported, underreported, or misreported. If Americans Knew has been around for more than 20 years. I don't know of any organization with a more comprehensive website about the conflict. It offers history about the conflict, statistics about the dead and injured on both sides, information about home demolitions and settlements, news about what is taking place daily in Gaza and the West Bank. Allison Weir, welcome to Understanding Israel-Palestine.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Allison, for the past 5 weeks, Understanding Israel-Palestine has been looking at the Israel lobby, particularly the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, commonly known as APAC, and the Anti-Defamation League, two particularly influential pro-Israel organizations. There are many more organizations that comprise what is sometimes called the Israel lobby, however. If Americans Knew has a listing of organizations and individuals it cites as being part of the Israel lobby. I'm wondering if you could talk about some of these other organizations, what they are, what they do, and what in your mind defines an organization or individual as being part of the Israel lobby as opposed to being simply sympathetic or supportive of Israel.
In recent years, more people have become aware of APAC. When I first started working on this issue about 24 years ago, it was rarely mentioned in news media and many people had not heard of it. But the fact is, as you're pointing out, APAC is just one of hundreds of organizations that advocate on behalf of Israel. It's the most prominent. It's the major one regarding Congress, but there are many other that are very significant. On our website, we list the individuals and institutions that work to influence Congress, the president, academia, the media, religious institutions, and the American public in general. We also point out that the Israel lobby has been very active in the United States for many, many decades. I wrote a book a few years ago about the history of the Israel lobby because I was surprised to learn that it had begun in the late 1800s. Something I'd never even heard of for most of my life, was active and very influential from 1890 on, especially becoming influential in about 1910 and 1920. It's a hugely important issue that's often overlooked or I think sometimes intentionally buried. But in terms of the organizations we list on our website, ifamericansknew.org, there are many groups and organizations, and they really span the political spectrum. Some come from the left, some come from the right. Some are relatively critical of some Israeli policies, but they're still advocating on behalf of Israel and support Israel. These are a wide array of groups. One of them that's very influential and prominent is the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. On our website, we have a link in every group showing where it advocates for Israel, so why we've included it. This particular group includes 51 organizations that advocate on behalf of Israel. Many of them focus on Iran. This particular conference has revenues of over $2 million. Then there's the American Israel Education Foundation. It's a subsidiary of AIPAC, but it's a separate organization. It takes Congress members on all expense paid trips to Israel, very lavish propaganda trips. AIPAC itself used to do that. That then became, or at least was known to be, illegal. So AIPAC basically set up a subsidiary that's supposedly separate that does the same thing. Its annual budget is in the range of about $26 million. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy is a very significant think tank. It was spun off by AIPAC. And you'll often see it quoted in the media without telling about the AIPAC connection and that it is a lobbying organization for a foreign country. Its net assets are again around $24, $25 million. It sounds like you've already covered the ADL, which is, of course, major.
There are many organizations and interests that lobby Congress. There's the gun lobby, the farm lobby, the banking lobby. Why do you think Americans should be concerned or at least know about the Israel lobby?
There are a number of important reasons. First of all, it dwarfs those other lobbies. Those are very significant lobbies. There are many lobbies. That's how our system works. It's completely acceptable and widely used. In this particular case, though, this is far more pervasive. We know about the NRA and other lobbies, but they generally just have a few organizations that are lobbying on that side. And usually there are also organizations lobbying on the other side. So it tends to balance things out, or at least we hope it does. But in this case, there are just numerous organizations. Some of them hide their names. There are political action committees that have fraudulent names, Northern Californians for Good Government, for example, that's actually donating money on behalf of Israel. The other thing is that this is the lobby on behalf of a foreign country. Most of these organizations, or certainly many of them, really should have been required to register as foreign agents. It's completely legal in the United States to lobby on behalf of a foreign government. There are many such lobbies. When you do that, however, you're required to register as a lobbyist for a foreign country. Israel eludes that. That's extremely significant. The other thing is that this lobby procures massive amounts of money from American taxpayers, often without American taxpayers knowing about it. In fact, more American tax money has gone to Israel over these many years than to any other foreign country. As Americans, we should know how our tax money is used. We should hope that it will be used in the best interests of our country and in a way that's moral and ethical and in the best interests, really, of all people. But that's not what's going on. It's getting distorted by a special interest lobby. To me, that's always problematic, no matter who's doing it. The fact that this is influential so many places, it's influential on campuses, it's in religious institutions, it's in state legislatures. So it's just so extremely pervasive that I think people should know about it.
Americans responded with shock and horror to Hamas's brutal October 7th attacks on Israel. As Israel's offensive in Gaza has gone on, many Americans are also feeling shock and horror at the brutality of its response. Israel has dropped what is the equivalent of two nuclear bombs on a captive population living on a very small amount of land. The Gaza Strip is less than half the size of Kansas City. It's 25 miles long by 5 miles wide. The continued bombing of the Gaza Strip, the mass displacement of people, the enormous casualties, 75,000, the man-made famine, all have increased American sympathy for Palestinians, and growing numbers believe Israel is conducting a genocidal campaign. That is less true for Jewish Americans, however. We're seeing an increasing divide between how Jewish Americans and non-Jews are seeing Israel's response. We're also seeing a division within the Jewish community, with younger Jews often playing a leading role in protests of Israel's actions, while older generations support it. Talk to us about the lobby's initial reaction to the October 7th attack and Israel's war on Gaza, and how, if at all, that may be changing after 6 months of war.
The Israel lobby initially, and some of the organizations still, really doubled down in their support of Israel. It's understanding at the very beginning after October 7th, when so many exaggerations were being voiced about what actually went on that day. While there was a huge amount of killing of civilians, which is always, always illegal and immoral, it wasn't as large as people have been led to believe. There were no, quote, beheaded babies, not a single one, even though many people still believe there were 40 of them. It's questionable to what degree there was any sexual violence whatsoever. Again, a lot of these initial claims have been refuted within the Israeli media themselves. But at the beginning, it was very shocking. This was the first time. Israel usually has all the power and kills people with impunity. In this particular case, this was what many people term a prison break. Gaza had been a prison since at least 2016, and really before that, when I went there, it was already largely a prison in early 2001. So this desperate population finally broke out of the prison. It's unclear still how it happened. The vaunted Israeli military that surveils Gaza with listening posts all over the place, with drones, etc., somehow seems to have missed this breakout. This was a shock to the Israeli public to come under attack for the first time where they were being killed in large numbers. As a result, there was this sort of circling of the wagons. Many people were treating it as though all Jews around the world were at risk, whereas that was far from true. Quickly, the attack ended, and Israel ever since has been bombing and killing Gazans in massive numbers with just a huge amount of power. The U.S. continues to give them weaponry. Biden administration gives them enormous amounts of weapons. But I think because of these initial claims and the fact that these claims are repeated over and over again, especially in the pro-Israel press and media and by those organizations, it's created a great fear among many Jewish Americans who think that they're under siege. Incorrectly, there's actually an excellent article that just came out in The Forward, which is a Jewish publication, a very venerable publication. In fact, I think it has the largest readership of any Jewish publication in the United States. Just published an article. We've republished it on our website. I'll read the title of it. The growing panic about anti-Semitism isn't a reflection of reality. It turns out, as this author says, who's a rabbi, a very pro-Israel rabbi, says the most obvious explanation for the current upsurge of alleged anti-Semitism is not a grand narrative of American or European anti-Semitism, but its rage at an ongoing war in which Israel's conduct has received widespread international condemnation. The article points out that a large share of the ADL's alleged anti-Semitic incidents appear to be expressions of hostility toward Israel and its actions rather than anti-Semitism. The article details how there have been a number of articles and other organizations intentionally producing fear among American Jewish people of all ages, but especially older Jewish Americans have fallen prey to that. The final point that the author makes, that's an excellent one, is that he says that the natural endpoint of such a view is perpetual paranoia together with an extreme form of right-wing Zionism. It dismisses human rights concerns since the oppression of our enemies is the, quote, regrettable price of Jewish survival. It's a very damaging trend that I've been watching going on ever since October 7th.
If you're just joining us, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margo Patterson, and I'm speaking with Allison Weir, director of If Americans Knew, about the response of pro-Israel groups to October 7th. Since the war in Gaza began, there's been increasing activism around the war on university campuses. There are complaints that protests against Israel's actions have made some Jewish students uncomfortable, even in some cases unsafe, that these protests are often anti-Semitic. The Department of Education is investigating dozens of colleges for reports of discrimination under Title IX, including elite universities such as Harvard, Yale, Princeton. The allegations of discrimination differ, and while some come from students, some come from outside organizations. What's your assessment of what's going on college campuses? Have universities become, in some cases, cesspools of anti-Semitism, as is sometimes being alleged? Or are these allegations overblown or in some cases fabricated to suppress pro-Palestine activism?
I believe they are definitely intended to suppress pro-Palestine activism. There's no doubt about that. I haven't been in any of these protests. I live out in the country, but I've looked into them. I certainly have been reading about them. It appears that they are a diverse array of students who are having demonstrations protected by free speech and really the expectations that people will speak out when there are abuses or something that's been plausibly called genocide on many campuses and in many communities around the United States. These accusations of anti-Semitism ignore the fact that many of the participants, some of the leaders, are often Jewish Americans. Sometimes they include Israelis. Some of the people who point this out quite well and in detail are Jewish themselves, sometimes Israelis. Glenn Greenwald is really one of my favorite journalists. He happens to be Jewish, and he has a nightly program on Rumble called System Update, I think is the title. He's a very fair journalist. He criticizes and exposes malfeasance across the political spectrum. He's been talking about Gaza quite a bit because given the fact that hundreds of people have been killed almost every day, most of them women and children, it's an important topic. He's had one program in particular in which he talked about some of the alleged anti-Semitism at Harvard, Princeton, and I think Penn was the third campus. He showed that this was actually not true, that the claims were fabricated and exaggerated. There was one person in particular who was behind it, who's an Israel supporter named Bill Ackman, who's a hedge fund CEO, I believe he's a billionaire, who had been pushing this and tried to make it impossible for Harvard students, for example, to get future jobs. Posted this one also on our website.
I'm glad you brought up William Ackman. He was a major force in ousting Harvard President Claudine Gay. He did, as you mentioned, try to publicize the names of Harvard students who had signed a letter saying Israel was ultimately responsible for the Hamas attacks because it had been imprisoning Gaza's population. What's the role of individuals in the lobby? Do you think they are minor players, or are they very much influential actors in very zealous support of Israel?
They are very significant because so many of them are billionaires. On our listing of the Israel lobby, there were so many organizations, it was so huge to go through that we finally made a table of contents for it. So we have the main categories are organizations, influential individuals, and additional resources. And under influential individuals, the first listing is billionaires. A number of years ago, when I started looking into this issue, I read a book published by a very reputable, very respected Jewish American journalist who's quite pro-Israel himself. He's still at the Forward. You know, he's a major journalist and author, and he had written a book called Jewish Power. And in this book, he said that Jewish billionaires made up half the billionaires in the United States were Jewish. Many of those are pro-Israel individuals. So they're wielding these massive fortunes, billions of dollars, on behalf of Israel. I can't think of any billionaires in the United States who are wielding that kind of power on behalf of Palestinians. So it's enormously disproportionate and extremely significant. There's people like Michael Bloomberg, Miriam Adelson, her husband Sheldon Adelson, who passed away a few years ago. There's Chaim Saban, major donor to the Democrats. They donate to both Democrats and to Republicans. As we know, the way it works when you're running for office is you need to get a huge amount of money when you're running for any national office, Congress or the president, and you need to get that money. If somebody's going to give you a lot of money, then you're going to do pretty much what they want. Or if you don't do what they want, you know that that money, it's not just that you won't receive it, it's that your opponent will receive it. There's Ronald Lauder, there's Aaron Lauder, there's Seth Klarman, there's the Pritzker family, enormously wealthy family. Many of these are families that are each individual is a billionaire.
This question about anti-Semitism on college campuses, anti-Semitism in in the United States. Gauging anti-Semitism depends, of course, on what a person views as anti-Semitic. I know you yourself have been accused of anti-Semitism. I'm sure that was very upsetting. How do you define anti-Semitism? Is there a point where being anti-Israel can pass into anti-Semitism? And what would you say that point is?
I think that the point would be, it is very upsetting, by the way. You know, I remember when I first just started telling about my trip to Gaza. I had traveled there as an independent journalist, just a freelance reporter back in early 2001 before 9/11, and saw what was going on, took pictures when I returned to the United States, told people about what I had personally seen and experienced in the West Bank and in Gaza. And I was immediately called anti-Semitic. Truthfully, I was pretty shocked to have that reaction. But very quickly, you learn that anybody that speaks honestly about Palestinians, about their treatment by Israel, will immediately be called anti-Semitic. It is standard fare. It's meant to marginalize or to eliminate, you know, sort of cancel people, as we call it now. That's the purpose of it, or to at least silence them. And it does silence many people who don't like being called such a nasty name. I would use the traditional and dictionary definition of anti-Semitism, which is bigotry or prejudice against Jewish people. That's what's wrong. Bigotry or prejudice against any population, Catholics or Christians or Muslims or liberals or conservatives, any such thing is wrong and should be condemned. And that's certainly true of those views towards Jewish Americans. I think what happens is that in some cases, criticism of Israel in some individual cases will result. People will see what Israel is doing and what it's been doing now for 6 months. On those tanks, on those soldiers are pictures of the Star of David, the symbol for Judaism in today's world. So it's immediately connected to being Jewish. Worse yet, I think what really causes what I would term real anti-Semitism, which is when somebody is blaming all Jews, which is inappropriate and incorrect, for Israeli actions, you find that every national mainstream Jewish organization in the United States advocates and supports Israel on one level or another, usually quite strenuously. They claim to represent all Jewish Americans. They don't, but they claim to do that. And so it is a natural conclusion that some people make, even though it's incorrect, to believe them and to believe, well, this killing of babies and children, Jews are in favor of that because that's what the Jewish organizations are implying to them. So when people say that, it is anti-Semitic, but quite likely it's growing out of the Jewish lobby making them believe such an incorrect conclusion.
The omnibus spending bill that was just passed in Congress cut all funding to UNRWA, the UN agency that is the chief humanitarian aid agency in Gaza and widely regarded as essential to the provision of aid by other aid groups working in Gaza. President Biden had already suspended U.S. aid to UNRWA in January following Israeli allegations that 12 UNRWA workers in Gaza had links to the Hamas attacks. These allegations have not been verified. The Financial Times and two television stations in the UK looked at the evidence behind the allegations and found them less than conclusive. There is an acknowledged humanitarian disaster in Gaza. What led Congress to stop aid to UNRWA in the middle of it? Is that attributable to lobbying by pro-Israel organizations? Or do you think Congress was just following President Biden's lead?
I think they were very mindful of what their donors wanted and did not want. If you look at Open Secrets, it's an organization that logs the amount of money that is given to different politicians by Israel lobbies and individuals. You'll find that our politicians on both sides of the aisle are receiving a lot of money from pro-Israel organizations. AIPAC itself does not give the money, but they've now actually formed a PAC for the first time about a year or two ago. So they do have a 501c4 that does give money to candidates. But it's these many individuals, many of them do it secretly. There's a method whereby you can bundle money to a politician. So there will be a fundraiser for some American politician, either a Republican or a Democrat. Israel partisans will invite their friends to come, and then they will all give a certain amount of money on their individual credit cards, making it appear that these are individual donations, but they were done at a fundraiser for Israel. A lot of times this amount of money that's going to politicians is being hidden from the public, but not from the politicians. They know where to get the money and what will prevent them from getting the money. Not only did they vote to defund this extremely important humanitarian organization, not just for refugees in Gaza, but around the world. They support many people that are in desperate need. But they also voted to give Israel over $4 billion of U.S. tax money. That works out to about over $10 million per day. And they voted for other items in the budget because they benefit Israel. And altogether, that comes out to, I think it's about $20 million per day in that bill alone expended on behalf of Israel.
We're seeing a shift among some Democrats in Congress about the war. They have from the outset overwhelmingly supported the Biden administration's response to the war, including the administration's continuing transfer of weapons to Israel. But after the Israeli targeted attack that killed 7 World Food kitchen workers April 1st, 30 House Democrats signed a letter expressing opposition to further U.S. arms transfers to Israel. Nancy Pelosi was among the letter signers, and she has always been staunchly pro-Israel. Is the Israel lobby losing some of its grip on Congress, or is the lobby itself changing?
I think overall, it's losing its grip to a degree. I think that's significant. I think Biden noticed that now there's a movement among many voters called Abandon Biden, people saying that they will not vote for Biden because he continues to give money and weaponry and shields Israel from international condemnation. Politicians, they must have hearts. Some of them tend to ignore them, but some of them are probably horrified at what they actually know is going on and are finally taking a position that's required by ethics and morality. Some of them are simply aware that their voters are aware of what's going on and they might suffer at the polls. I think this is a significant change. The problem is among conservative voters, many who watch Fox News, it appears that they are being deprived of many, many facts about what's going on in the region, and in many cases have no idea.
My understanding is that you started If Americans Knew because you thought if more Americans really knew the facts about what was going on in Israel and Palestine, they would be outraged and would demand a change in U.S. policy towards Israel and its occupation of the Palestinian territories. We're seeing what are credible allegations of genocide. There are protests on university campuses, but I am struck by the silence of churches and the silence of most Americans. Do you still have the same faith that if Americans knew more, they would change their government's policy?
I do. I still feel that. I hope I'm right. But I feel that still most people don't know, even though the media coverage has gotten better than it used to be. It's still really less than full, so that many people don't know what's going on. Fox News and the conservative media are often covering this very poorly. And even the liberal media that have gotten better still often gives Israel spin. So they're still being told, well, it's really sad that Gazans are suffering, but it's because of Hamas, which is not true. But that's the conclusion they're led to believe. When people know the full facts, in many cases, they are speaking out and demanding change. Some won't do that. They don't want to be called anti-Semitic, and they're just never politically active, which is sad because our nation requires people to become active on policy issues. But I do believe that if everybody knew what I know, they would demand different policies, and I think eventually we'll get there.
That was Allison Weir of If Americans Knew. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine.